How much stuff, macroeconomically speaking, is too much stuff? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 18th day of August. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. You know, one could make a case, as we are about to, it turns out, that the biggest challenge in this economy the past maybe 2 months, and I mean that, of course, aside from inflation, we're just going to stipulate that, but the biggest challenge might be another I word, inventories. Retailers have way too much of it still on shelves and in warehouses, piled up wherever they can store it. See also the recent woes of Walmart and Target. We've been telling you about that. And the challenge of the inventory challenge is how soon retailers can move past their fight with all that unsold stuff. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Last year's fresh hell for retailers was not knowing whether they would get their products in on time or at all. Customers wanted more stuff. Supply chains were dysfunctional.
Consumers shifted $1 trillion worth of spending from services to goods that retailers had to catch up with.
Jonathan Gold is with the National Retail Federation. So a lot of companies made changes. They started placing orders earlier.
Where typically it's, you know, 6 months or so in advance when retailers are placing orders, moving that up to 9 months or even 12 months to try and get ahead of some of these other challenges.
So retailers then had to become fortune tellers, predicting what they would need and when they would need it much further in advance than usual.
It's hard to know what you're going to need because consumer preferences and consumer desires for goods have been swinging all over the place.
Phil Levy is chief economist at Flexport.
It's hard to know when it's going to arrive because we've had a whole bunch of supply chain difficulties.
A lot of companies got it wrong. Very, very wrong. Consumers shifted back towards services. Inflation changed which things consumers wanted to buy. Stephen Bethel is head of Fraser Capital.
A lot of the companies we work with have seen inventories rise by about probably 25 to maybe 30% over the last 4 months.
Warehouses are filling up. Ports are backing up, according to Flexport. So what are retailers doing? Well, a lot of them are gritting their teeth and slashing prices. Michael Zdenek is director of economics for S&P Global.
And so consumers who are doing their back-to-school shopping should expect good bargains, not just on school supplies, but also on these extra inventories that are sitting on retailer shelves.
Will that be enough? No, it won't. At least not at first.
Now, sales have been flat the last couple months. And so with the level of inventories that we're seeing, that's not, the problem isn't going away anytime soon.
Some companies may just have to hold on to this stuff, occasionally destroy it. Meanwhile, consumers may get some much-needed deals at a time of stifling inflation. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I've said it before, I will say it again. We consumers are a fickle bunch. Wall Street today, just a hair more buying than selling. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The thing about inflation is that it affects everybody, not evenly to be sure, but everybody nonetheless. It affects businesses too. Companies have to make price and cost calculations for whatever kinds of widgets they sell or services that they offer, but also about the people that they pay. And that's a cost calculation too, as they try to keep workers in what is a very worker-friendly economy right now. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
A little over a year ago, St. Louis software developer Jeannie Lin took a new job and a small pay cut to do work that felt more meaningful, teaching programming to non-traditional students at a nonprofit. But then inflation started making that small pay cut feel bigger.
I've got children, I've got, you know, a family of four to feed, and so food costs, just everything is a little bit tighter.
So she was pleasantly surprised when she opened her company's weekly all-staff email late last month.
And then this one was discussing the inflation concerns, and there was not a bunch of, like, let's all talk, what would help you? It was just, here, this is what we're doing.
The company gave all employees a larger-than-expected annual raise and a one-time bonus to help with rising costs.
And I was like, wow, I should read these bulletins all the time. This is great news.
A recent survey from the Society for Human Resource Management found about 3/4 of HR departments are concerned about how inflation is affecting their workforce. And we've seen big companies like Microsoft, Walmart, and Exxon give mid-year pay bumps this summer. Jill Chapman with HR services firm Insperity says some have simply moved up the pay increases that typically come at year end, hoping inflation will calm down.
They've just flipped the calendar a little bit and let's go ahead and help people now rather than waiting.
Not all businesses are in a position to permanently increase pay. She says many are being squeezed by inflation themselves.
You know, if people really want to get clever and creative, there are lots of perks that you can offer.
Things like extra paid time off, childcare, free lunches. One business even considered Costco memberships. Luke Pardue is an economist with Gusto, a payroll and benefits platform that serves small businesses.
Despite a lot of this economic uncertainty right now, workers still are in the driver's seat of this labor market.
And the driver's seat is where they often need help. He says over the last year, gas stipends from companies on the platform have become bigger and more common, expanding beyond transportation and logistics to industries like leisure and hospitality.
Where the number of job openings is still historically high, where the job market is particularly tight, and where these employees aren't necessarily able to work remotely as often.
But these kinds of small gestures can get even smaller after taxes and can sometimes feel downright insulting if a company has neglected bigger issues, says David Buckmaster, the author of Fair Pay and a former compensation analyst at Nike and Starbucks.
I can remember one very large retailer that, there was a huge backlash because they launched a meditation app, and there was this whole response to say, we didn't want a meditation app. We wanted to be able to pay our rent.
For employees like Jeannie Lin, sometimes a simple message speaks loudest.
Like all the warm and fuzzy messages cannot compare with, I know something that'll help. Here's some more money. Thank you. That really does help.
Even more, she says, because she didn't have to ask for it. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
I believe I've mentioned a time or three in the past months and years that Marketplace World headquarters here in downtown Los Angeles is a lonely, lonely place. Three of us, usually, in tens of thousands of square feet. Working from home is still very much a thing for a whole lot of companies, but not all, because in some parts of the country, just about everybody's making that daily commute and has been for a while. Emma Goldberg writes about the future of work for the New York Times, including just the other day, about how, depending on where you are, the remote office debate is over and the office won. Emma, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Were you surprised by the data that you found as you were reporting this story?
I was not, because I do get the sense that there's increasingly kind of two Americas. And there's one in which, like, the workplace has been kind of upended. People have spent the past, now more than 2 years working on their couches or, working from Airbnbs or traveling. And then there are a lot of workers who have been either in person the whole time or have returned en masse much earlier than maybe people have in New York City and San Francisco. So there's increasingly a sort of splintering.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned those two cities, because that was the next question, which is that based on what I read from you and your reporting, the big cities that basically emptied out are much slower to come back than some of the smaller places in this country where people have come back in sort of greater percentages.
Yeah, so there's a couple of factors that point toward whether people are going to be back in the office in a given city. One of those is whether people commute by car, because if you're reliant on mass transit, then you're more likely to have stayed home for longer. And the other is how long those cities locked down for the pandemic. So cities that had much more restrictive pandemic lockdowns are much less likely to have gotten people back in the office at this point.
Do you think, sorry, this is a little sort of off the briefing, I guess, but
What is your sense of companies and the expectation that people will come back to the office, right? I mean, you see companies saying, you know, a lot of Wall Street firms in the beginning were like, oh, yep, you got to come back 5 days a week. That's how we make our money. Do you get the sense that that's where companies are leading, or are they just going to go, hey, you want to work on your couch, work on your couch?
I think that a lot of companies have been kicking the can down the road for long enough that now it does kind of feel like it's actually starting to get real. And I think a lot of them are pinning their hopes on Labor Day, and they're still thinking maybe there'll be that, you know, turnaround at the start of a new school year. And I think a lot of others are still, you know, trying to decide how firmly they're going to put their feet down, or they're still in experimental mode, seeing what works and what actually gets people back.
Yeah, where are you right now? Were you reporting from home, or are you reporting from the office somewhere?
I am in the office, actually, today.
There you go. Today. So that's the other thing. Sorry, I'm glad you mentioned that. We're not talking 5 days a week here, right?
Many places aren't. So a lot of people are still kind of experimenting, and they're seeing, can we get people back 3 days?
Right.
Can we get people back one day? Wednesday across the country is a really popular day for people to be back in the office, according to the data.
Yeah, and of course, Mondays and Fridays, not so much, which totally makes sense. This is the future, right? This is kind of where we are, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely in a brave new world of work. And even some of the companies that had said, okay, we really want to see you back, they haven't necessarily been willing to put their foot down. You know, a lot of them were eyeing last fall, and then the Delta variant intervened. Yep. They were eyeing January, and then the Omicron variant intervened. And each time that they had to delay, they lost some leverage.
Right. It's speaking of leverage, it's worth a mention here that there is a cadre of people in this country, among whom my oldest son is one, who basically say, you know, if you make me be in the office 5 days a week, I don't want to work there, you know?
Definitely. And I think with the labor market, as strong as it is, they do have a lot of opportunities to point them in other directions.
Right. Emma Goldberg, she covers the workplace at the New York Times. Emma, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Coming up.
If you spend $1 million advertising Brewster County, is that enough?
I don't know. Is it? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 18 points today, less than a 10%, really, 33,999. The NASDAQ up 27 points, about 0.2%, 12,965. The S&P 500 added 9 points, about a 0.25%. 42.83. $650 million. That's how much a federal judge has ordered CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart to pay to two Ohio counties. You might have heard that yesterday. Last year, the jury found those retailers liable for contributing to the opioid epidemic. So, shares in CVS Health gave up 1.2%. Today, Walgreens Boots Alliance fell 5.3%. Walmart shed about 0.3%. Sales of existing homes fell by 5.9% from June to July. That's according to the National Association of Realtors, the sixth straight monthly drop. So real estate broker Remax Holdings added 1%. Berkshire Hathaway, another big player in residential real estate sales. You might not have known that. Basically unchanged. Today you're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are in a drought. And when I say we here, I mean, yes, I'm talking about those of us out here in California, but it's also kind of a collective we, because we're talking the American West and Texas, Norway and China, too.
And you think drought, you of course think agriculture and regular everyday human water use, I suppose. But it turns out water and the lack of it plays a real big role in an industry we have been talking a whole lot about these days. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on what drought means for your electricity bill.
So the first thing that comes to mind when many folks think of the connection between drought and electricity is dams.
Hydropower plays a very unique role in our electricity grid.
Caitlin Grady studies the energy-water nexus at George Washington University.
Because even though it's not a very large percentage of our total sort of electricity generation, it's used for really important purposes.
Like she says, when power demand peaks, hydro can be used to meet that demand in short order. Hydropower is also used to start power plants back up when they've been shut down for whatever reason. It's called a black start. Ashlyn Stillwell at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign says it's not just hydropower that's affected by water shortages.
The larger amount of electricity production in the United States, bigger than hydropower, is thermal power generation.
Things like coal, natural gas, and nuclear. They're burning fuel that generates steam that moves a turbine, and you need water to make that steam. Not only that, they need water as a cooling agent.
And so consequently, those power plants, those thermal power plants, are dependent on water to cool the system to generate electricity.
And if power plants can't get water for whatever reason, they're going to have a hard time producing that electricity. A big problem during times like the summer when demand is really high and creates scarcity.
Which would mean an increase in wholesale electricity prices, at least in the short term, while these drought conditions persist.
Yael Glazer is a research associate at the University of Texas at Austin. She says if that continues, she suspects those higher prices will eventually make their way down to ratepayers. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
It's been a couple of years now, a couple of pandemic years to be clear, that most public schools in this country have been offering students free meals, all students. The pandemic's not done, but the federal pandemic lunch program is, and so with the start of the new school year, eligible students are going to have to re-enroll or enroll in free or reduced price lunch programs, and others are just going to have to pay. As Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, history tells us why, for most students, there is no such thing as a free lunch.
The National School Lunch Program has its roots in recruiting soldiers for World War II.
Men between the ages of 18 and 26 can go into training immediately.
Many of those young men had grown up in the Great Depression, and they were malnourished.
They were not physically fit, a surprisingly high percentage. Truman was disturbed by that.
That's archivist Randy Soule at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library. In 1946, Truman signed a law establishing nationwide public school lunches. One of its goals was to find a way to use surplus agricultural products. Ashton Ellett is an archivist at the University of Georgia.
We're talking peanuts, milk, beef, things that human beings consume on a daily basis.
The idea of providing free lunches didn't really enter the conversation. Again, Randy Soule at the Truman Library.
There was some rhetoric to the effect that you should not be teaching children at an early and impressionable part of their lives to expect handouts from the federal government.
A 2010 law allowed districts with a certain percentage of students on government assistance to provide free meals to everyone. Emily Gutierrez with the Urban Institute says a majority of American parents the group surveyed want free meals to be universal, especially after their kids got them for 2 years.
Folks respond much worse to the removal of some benefit rather than to be provided the benefit for the first time. So that means it's going to be harder to take something away from families than it is to decide to give it to them in the first place.
Now that the federal government isn't providing free lunches, California has started providing them itself. And Colorado voters will decide whether to do so in November. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
According to the National Park Service, Big Bend National Park, way out in West Texas, along a Big Bend in the Rio Grande, is seeing record tourism, more than 500,000 visitors last year. With all those people, though, have been coming some frustrations over something called an hotel occupancy tax. They're not unique to Texas, those taxes. Lots of states and cities have them. But it's how they can be used in Texas that's got people hung up. From Marfa Public Radio, Travis Bubenik's got the story.
Off a rocky road in the borderlands tourist town of Terlingua, Daryl Eby shows off his Big Bend Stargazer Airbnb.
This I would classify as glamping. Yeah, this is nice. There's a small TV.
It's a vintage but renovated Airstream trailer perched on a hillside with sweeping views of the surrounding Chihuahuan Desert.
From here on the deck, we've got a view of Big Bend National Park, the Chisos Mountains, Castellon Peak.
Eby manages more than 30 short-term rentals here, making him one of the biggest local lodging business owners. Lately, he's also been raising concerns about lodging-related taxes. In Texas, state law limits how these special taxes can be used. The money mostly has to go back into promoting tourism, with some wiggle room. The taxes can be used for arts programs and historic preservation, but they can't pay for things like roads or public housing. And because the Big Bend's already seeing record-high tourist numbers, EB argues the tax rate should be lower.
They're basically just throwing away money now on extra advertising, much of which is probably not seeing any significant or necessary return on investment.
Brewster County has a 7% lodging tax rate that gets tacked onto a guest's short-term rental bill. The county then funnels that money into a local tourism council that runs tourism marketing campaigns. This fiscal year, county records show the tax has already brought in more than $1 million.
It does beg the question, you know, when can we say that's enough to spend?
Sarah Allen Calando is a local county commissioner.
If you spend $1 million advertising Brewster County, is that enough? Or do you have to spend 1.2 next year? Do you have to spend 1.4 next year? Can you just say like, okay, $1 million a year is enough?
Calando says she'd like to see the county's tourism marketing budget, quote, plateau, and then officials could find something else to do with the rest of the money. Robert Alvarez, who heads up the County Tourism Council, is on board with that. He says the council's already planning to use some of the tax money for things that the law does allow, like new visitor centers with amenities like public restrooms.
My organization doesn't have to keep bringing more and more people. We're at a sustainable level right now.
Still, what's sustainable here is up for debate. Skyrocketing tourist numbers have come with the same challenges that other communities face, like a housing shortage as Airbnb numbers grow and strained water supplies as people build new properties. The state's hotel industry has largely opposed any broad expansion of lodging tax laws that could allow the money to be used to address those kinds of infrastructure problems. Though lawmakers have passed some specific expansions in certain towns.
The compromise has always been that's something that the industry will tolerate, you know, provided that the money is used to promote the area as a tourism destination.
Justin Bragels with the trade group Texas Hotel and Lodging Association.
And I understand there's some communities that would say we don't want any more visitors or tourists, but that ship has sailed, so to speak, right?
Still, Daryl Eby says if lawmakers would allow some changes to the tax uses here, there are plenty of things the community could use the money for.
Grants to help a restaurant owner open up, or to incentivize someone to open a new gas station, or to provide a housing assistance for locals. There's a lot of need out here.
Meanwhile, there's been a related problem lately of some Big Bend rental owners not paying these special taxes. Officials are gearing up to go after those unpaid taxes, so it's likely this rural area will have even more tourism-driven cash on hand in the future. But at least for now, it's also likely that money won't be used to address some of the region's most pressing problems. In Marfa, I'm Travis Bubenik for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's more of a context thing, actually. We got first-time claims for unemployment benefits today, as we do every Thursday. 250,000 people filed for jobless benefits for the first time in the week ended August 13th. That's down just a hair, which is good. And I mentioned the date because last week, that is, the week ended the 13th, was what's called the reference week for the monthly unemployment report, the biggie. The reference week is the week the Department of Labor does its surveys of companies to talk about jobs that they have added and of people to ask whether they are looking for work. And yes, weekly claims and the two monthly surveys are different beasts, but today's news could be a promising sign for the end of the month. All right, out we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Saw this in Bloomberg today to be filed under, yeah, total spending on crypto ads on TV in February, $84.5 million. Total spending on crypto ads on TV in July, $36,000. Fortune favors the brave indeed. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that the guy who said that, Pliny the Elder, he said it, he sailed off toward Vesuvius, and he died. So there's that. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein. History is cool, I'm telling you. John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.